I am older than almost every single one of you in this room. I'm 56 years of age. Well, I'm just saying, there's the thing I'm making reference to is American history. I come from Washington, D.C., and to the left of my mother is Joan Baez and a wall. To the right of my father is Joseph Stalin, a Fox News host on vacation, and a wall. And so I was passed between the two households. So 5 days a week, I get Bob Dylan and We Shall Overcome. And 2 days a week, I get my father on whiskey and making me sing the national anthem over and over again on his front lawn. His opinion was if you inhaled marijuana, you would turn gay and the empire would crumble. And so that was kind of the mood and the attitude of marijuana in Washington, D.C. when I was in high school, where if you knew someone who smoked marijuana, the perception was, he's not lazy, he's evil. He's a deviant. And this is when gay people were called queer and homophobia and misogyny was everywhere. It was on TV, it was on the radio. That's all fine. But marijuana is bad. And then we heard about a thing called paraquat. And the whole time, I'm going to a prep school for boys. And there was no lighter levity in that environment. And one time, a kid, a 14-year-old kid, I was like 16 or 17, he brings onto the back of the bus a joint. It's about the diameter of a knitting needle. There's no marijuana in this. It's mostly paper and spit. He's like, hey, look what I've got. And we're looking like, are you insane? You have marijuana on this bus. He might as well have had a bomb. We're all terrified to stand next to him. We're all going to go to jail. You realize, I've seen a joint. Oh, no. And then, right around that time, I started going to Arena Rock. And I saw Aerosmith with REO Speedwagon opening. And the entire Capitol Center in Largo, Maryland, smelled like cheap arena weed. And I remember standing next to Ian MacKay from the band Fugazi. We've been best friends since we were 12. We're standing next to each other like, do you smell that? Oh my God, people around us are smoking marijuana. Are we going to be okay? Because we didn't exactly believe Reefer Madness, but we thought part of it might be true. And this was the perception of marijuana not even a few decades ago in this country. And so the point I'm making is, just in our lifetimes, we have come a long, long damn way. And so in the years that went forward, me not smoking, I started meeting more and more people who used cannabis. In high school, I wanted to meet girls, and I was shy and didn't have the hookup. So I would hang out with people who knew where parties were. And so I would go to these awful prep school parties where you were immediately judged, and you'd go in, and there's these guys, you know, from the rowing team, like, what school do you go to? I don't care about talking to you. I want to talk to the girl standing next to you. Get out of our party. And no one wanted me. And then after, outside of most of these parties, were the ne'er-do-wells who couldn't get in. And they were the ones smoking weed. And like, hey man, did you go in there? Yeah, they didn't want me. Come and hang with us. We're the potheads. The potheads. And that's where I found out I should buy Robin Trower records, because I would hang out with the potheads, who eventually I found out to be the greatest of skateboarders, because they were calm and without fear. And I would go to these skate ramps in the woods, in the suburbs, and you smell marijuana, which is no longer an unfamiliar smell in my life. And you'd see these guys utterly stoned dropping into these half pipes, like, watch this, man. You try it. Absolutely not. I'm afraid of gravity and I have no grace whatsoever. And so it was not this thing where, oh, you're stoned and you can't do anything. You are stoned and you are capable of quite a bit. And it was my on-the-street interaction with cannabis and cannabis users that started to change my mind. I got it from the real events. And so then I joined Black Flag, and I go into this punk rock world where there's a lot of speed, a lot of cocaine, a lot of anger, a lot of death, sadly. And I lived in Redondo Beach, a little south of the airport. And Black Flag did not necessarily hang out with people who went to the shows. They were maniacs. But our neighborhood was full of stoners. And we would hang out, and that's not exactly a pejorative, but that's what they called themselves. And they would call us, hey man, we're having a party in our garage. You guys want to come and play? Yeah, we'll come and play. We'll play this insane, aggressive Hyenas on the Serengeti Plains music at your stoner party. Absolutely. So we go in there loading our gear like a bunch of feral barracudas. Like, here's our music. And the stoner like, all right. And the place, I would play in basements full of pot. And this what the main stoner, the guy who would throw the parties, his name was Casey. And Casey would come up to me like, hey, man, we know you don't drink. And we know you know you don't smoke, man. So we got together, man, and we got you a Martinelli's apple juice, man, because we know you like to be healthy, and we're so happy you're here. I damn near wept. Like, the stoners are the nicest people. And then we would go play one of our own shows where people are standing in front of us like, you suck, and I paid $4 to beat you up. And so I started enjoying hanging out with the people on marijuana, and I never was curious to ever try it, but I liked being around these people who were so friendly and so cool and so sane and so rational.
Henry spoke wonderfully about the war on drugs, its impact on the poor, minorities, and such.
It's a war on the poor and exactly. Minorities. And it's a war that wins because it loses. And that's why, unless you and I really move forcefully, it will never end because it's too much of a moneymaker. And that's these people know. If it ends, you can no longer lock up black, brown, and poor people as easily as you can now. And as you know, you have about 50-50. Using cannabis, black, white, in this country. Overwhelmingly, like 3 to 1, you have African Americans incarcerated because of cannabis or nonviolent drug offenses. And so the racism is yeah. It can't be more in your face. And like I said, if the beds start emptying because we legalize, they'll find a new thing to criminalize and they'll make the way into the system. They'll grease it up and you'll find a new way to slide into it. And so it is a war, and it's won by being lost. It's a scam. It's like so many things in this country. It's a scam. It's a scam. It's a scam. Like the Iraq War, it was a scam. 5 people got paid, and thousands of people got blown up or just destroyed psychically or physically. But Dick Cheney and 4 other people got rich. And as always, so many things in this country from day one to now, it's a scam. And you and I, we are the anti-scam. That wasn't a question you asked me. I went off anyway, so go ahead.
Well, part of that discussion... Part of that discussion does touch into the areas of mass incarceration and privilege in our society. I'm wondering, as someone who worked in the major label world, do you have any examples of how rock stars got away with things that we wouldn't have gotten away with, privilege-wise, law-wise?
Statutory rape? I mean, no, rock stars get away with all kinds of things. It's a privileged class. On the bright side of things, on days when museums are closed, they open them for you. Wings of major art galleries open for you. These are the advantages I take. Yeah. You get to have rock star tours of the Library of Congress and the National Archives and sit in a room with the first 26 years of Congress and look at documents from Adams and Lincoln and all that, which I did. There's also things people would see me on stage and that they'd find me in the men's room later like, you want more speed? Because they thought I was on speed. And I'm like, oh, no, I can't get near that. They're like, oh, come on, man, you're not high? I'm like, I'm high on life. And so there's a lot of things offer you. There's a lot of pleasuring that can come your way from people offering their assets to all kinds of things. They get away with all kinds of things. But what a lot of people get away with is the crime of mediocrity, of selling mediocre product, of forcing bands who aren't ready yet to make a record and go on tour. They're ripening. They need another year in the clubs before you push them out onto a big stage because they just wanted the money. So these bands are basically grown like menudo, and when they don't sell enough, they're just tossed away, and they grab from the farm team, and they put them in there. It's a scam. And they make money off young people and their youth and their vitality. And they sell this. It's like Soylent Green. They grind up these people and feed these people back to them. And that's why the major label industry failed, because they stopped doing good things and they just went for money instead. And thankfully, it blew up in their face. And now you have the stuff that you see at the halftime Super Bowl games. It's just like, wow, they dance so well, and she's wearing no clothes. That's, wow, is that a bit of labia? But, like, how little clothes can she wear? She's really pushing it, but no artistic thing is pushed. It's just pudenda, Latin, eighth grade. A long time ago in the major label industry, the art used to dictate the industry. And then the industry started to dictate the art. I remember somewhere in the 80s, record labels started putting out unbelievable mediocre crap. And guess what? They lost everything. Whole floors of major label buildings went dark because they're laying off staff, because everyone finally went, you know what? This music sucks. And it costs too much. And you're treating us like idiots. So stop. And thankfully, I loved it when that happened because I knew I was right all the time. And thankfully, the major labels came into the breach, and now the independent labels, rather. And the independent labels are now better than ever. The best bands in America are on independent labels. And if you contact these labels, someone writes you back. When your record arrives dented, they send you another one. Why? Because they care. Or they'll have to be like, we have to get back to you in 6 weeks. We only made 40 of these, man. I got to go to my dad's house to get the other one I left behind the couch. Hold on, dude, we'll get back to you. Where it's real personal. I'm hoping that you all understand that you serve the community you'll be setting up your store in, and that is of great importance, to know the people who come into your shop. You are, in effect, a mom-and-pop store, and these people who are buying from you, if you're only in the business to sell something and make money, I'm not going to say screw you, I like you too much for that. I'm just saying you're failing the job. In my opinion, you're selling not only a product that makes people happy, but you're selling medicine. You're selling something that can help get someone off an opioid addiction. And so you are basically up against big pharma, big agriculture, the prison industrial complex, and the entirety of the Trump administration. Because now they're finding that cannabis can help with men and women who have returned from this awful war in Iraq and Afghanistan, and it helps them with their PTSD. They're finding that there's all kinds of things that cannabis can do. You've always known this. I've always known this. And so you are an affront and a threat to their bottom line. And they love money more than they love you, of course.